You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. Yesterday, pretty unbelievable day, especially if you lived in Southern California, and you're a sports fan of any kind. Obviously, the death of Kobe Bryant is kind of reverberated around the world, and especially here in Southern California. So we'll talk about that a little bit today, and you know, then as the day goes on, right, and the for me, it starts with my son Patrick, you know, texting a link, and you see the story, and you're like, no, that, like, I think everybody's reaction is disbelief, right? That can't be true. I mean, he's too young, and like, what the, you know, and then you start reading the story, and then you start checking, and sadly, the when stuff like this happens, the place that is normally first with the most accurate news is TMZ. And so you go there and you see the headline, you're like, yeah, they don't get it wrong very often when this kind of stuff happens. And you know, with Michael Jackson, I know, and some other stories that escape me now, but it's like, wow, you know, it's actually true. And so then as you watch, you know, you're just watching for like what happened, you know, how could this happen? And so everybody knows, I mean, yesterday, all from Southern Orange County, where I live kind of in, how would I describe I probably live in Central Orange County. Right, San Clemente down there is Southern Orange County, and then you go north of me, Huntington Beach, and there's places beyond Huntington Beach that are part of Orange County. That's North Orange County. Anyway, from where I live in Central Orange County, where the airport is, airport maybe a mile from me, and I mean it was foggy. It was, you know, it was overcast and foggy. And so the, my phone's blowing up here. The, so it's foggy. And as the day goes on, you know, you just, now the part of me that's ridden in helicopters, right, says, okay, everything I've seen about this guy's helicopter says it was a limousine. It's dual engine. So the idea that both engines, you know, go catastrophic simultaneously and he can't get it to the ground, you know, the probability of that is really low. You know, and when visibility is this bad, you know, like what happened? How could whoever was piloting? And I originally thought it was Kobe Bryant that was piloting, because so much of what I read said that he piloted that thing a lot. So anyway, so then that part of me starts like, you know, like, well, what happened? And now what's amazing, and I don't care if we're talking about, you know, the collision of the John McCain in the Moluccan Straits, or the collision of the USS Fitzgerald in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, you can get information so fast because of, you know, digital technology and satellites. It's absolutely amazing. And so within relatively short order, right, on the internet is the communications between the pilot and air traffic controllers in the Los Angeles in the Los Angeles basin, and then there's the exact flight path that they, you know, the aircraft actually takes off from Long Beach, comes down here to Orange County, picks up Kobe Bryant and some people, the coach of the baseball team that's three blocks from me, Orange Coast College, a guy by the name of John Altobelli, his wife and his daughter. I guess all of them, you know, have daughters that play on this basketball team, and they're going to fly up to Thousand Oaks to watch this thing. So let me draw an air diagram for you. All right, now you may or may not be able to follow this, but you could draw this diagram if you want to. Okay, so if you take a piece of paper. And I'm doing it. You can hear the paper moving. If you draw a line across the top of the page, okay, from side to side. Now, let's see. Maybe 2 or 3 inches, okay. You're going to draw a T. But the T is going to be let's see. Instead of being in the middle, you're going to move it maybe a third of the page to the left, okay. So the T, the top part of the T, and then that line's going to come all the way down the bottom. The vertical line's going to come all the way down the bottom of the page. So the T's not going to extend, maybe extend two-thirds of the way across the page. All right. So that's Orange County and Los Angeles. At the bottom of the page, draw a circle. Okay? And then put a finger between the bottom circle, above the bottom circle, and then draw another circle. Okay? All right. So then you start looking at the track that they fly, and you're just like, how? I mean, his 13-year-old daughter, right? And all these other people, like, so you're reading in the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department grounded their helicopters. Yesterday morning, the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department grounded their helicopter, saying they don't meet our criteria for getting in the air. The visibility conditions do not meet our criteria for getting in the air. And so it's like, we're talking about a basketball game here, you know? So if the, you know, to me, it's a pretty short discussion. LA Sheriff's Department, LA Police Department aren't flying. We're not flying until they're flying. So shut it down. We'll be late for the game, or we won't, or we can hop in the car, and it's about maybe on a Sunday morning, You know, it might be 90 minutes to get up there, depending on traffic. Hop in the HOV lane and keep your fingers crossed that there's no accidents, and we'll get up there. You know, we'll be late, but anyway, the decision gets made to fly. So now, let me just lay out. So the bottom circle, that's John Wayne Airport. So put JW next to that. And in about, let's see, in about a half hour, F-18 man Kurt Knoll is going to join us. And he's going to do what we tend to do on days like this, which is explain me ask stupid, you know, questions and him explain it. Now, the cool thing about Kurt is, you know, he's a pilot. And but, you know, he's a person, you know, he flies himself around, you know, when he can. And when he has access to airplanes. And so he's familiar with, you know, the rules of the road in the LA Basin, how it works. So anyway, he's going to join us in about 30 minutes. So that bottom circle is John Wayne. That's the airport in Orange County. The circle above that, that's the Long Beach Airport. Okay. Now, between the top line that goes all the way across the page, right, and the top of the T, and remember, the T extends two-thirds way across the page, and then the vertical line comes down from the middle of that. Okay. At the edge of the page between those two lines, put a circle. Okay? That's Thousand Oaks. That's where the Mamba, right, Academy was. You can abbreviate it, TO. And then right above at the T where the vertical line intersects the horizontal line, you put an X there. That's where the crash occurs. All right. So the top line are the mountains, right, that separate Southern California from the San Joaquin Valley. You go over those mountains, you know, and this, I don't know how many, it might be 40 miles worth of mountains, but you go over those mountains, right? So as you work your way south, the top line of the T, okay, those are the mountains that start just, you know, that make up Malibu, okay? You start on the coast highway runs at the bottom of it, right? So you have Malibu on the southern side, you keep going, you have Pacific Palisades, you have Brentwood, where O.J. lived, where he did his stuff, where Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman were murdered. You go across the 405, and you have Bel Air, you have Westwood, where UCLA is, you have Beverly Hills, right, and then you go towards Hollywood, and then at the end of that is where Dodger Stadium is. Yeah. And just south of that, if you draw a really big circle, that's where all the big skyscrapers are in L.A., right, and Staples Center and all that stuff is. So that's kind of your white trash map this morning. So I don't know if they were picking somebody up in Glendale, but they flew to Glendale. Now, Glendale is maybe a finger, right, above and to the right of Dodger Stadium at the end of the T line, okay, at the right end of the T line. So if you put – so the track shows them flying there, and then they circle there for a while. Now, they would have had no reason to go there. The shortest distance between John Wayne Airport and Thousand Oaks is to fly over the ocean and up the coast, and then come into Thousand Oaks from the west. That would be the shortest line. But they go through Los Angeles. They circle around Glendale, the San Gabriel Airport, I believe. But they can't land because the weather conditions won't permit. And so then they're trying to get west now. All right, that's what I found out. That I had not turned on, I hadn't opened the channel. So anyway, you know, I think as the story plays out, what we're all going to find out is there was a family waiting at the San Gabriel Airport to be picked up, and that there should have been more than 9 people on that plane. The aircraft then tries to fly west, and they're having a hard time with visibility. So I guess they get told, go further north. just south of, just this side of that top line is a highway called the 118 that runs along the base. And they said, you know, they were following the 118. Well, then there's another strip of mountains. And we'll talk to F-18 man about this. There's another strip of mountains that you would bump into. And they separate what's known as the San Fernando Valley from the Caneo Valley. San Fernando Valley, home to Northridge, home to Encino, places like that, Studio City. That's what's called the valley. Thousand Oaks sits in another valley called the Caneo Valley. And so we'll talk to Kurt and ask him. It looks like what happened is that they flew along the 118 and followed it, and they were headed south. Because, I mean, why would they crash into the mountains in Calabasas? Why would they be headed in that direction? And the answer I might be, and we'll talk to Kurt about this, but they were following the 118. Visibility sucked. Why were they that low? They were looking for landmarks. You know, I don't, you know, and he drove it into a, you know, the pilot drives it into a mountain. So anyway, F-18 man, I'm going to come on here in a little bit. I want to play some audio from Jerry West. And of all the audio that I heard yesterday, it's about 10 minutes, and this will probably take us to Kurt, but it was some of the most heart-wrenching audio, you know, I heard. Jerry West was, first of all, Jerry West from West Virginia. He is an awesome guy. His nickname is the logo, right? So if you look at the NBA logo, that silhouette of the guy dribbling the ball, right? That's Jerry West, right? That's a picture of Jerry West that they used, and hence his nickname, the logo. Grew up in West Virginia, had nothing, right? Goes to the University of West Virginia, on to the Los Angeles Lakers, you know, has this has a great career, becomes a general manager. And Jerry West is somewhat of a legend, just for the kind of person he is. And so you're going to hear Jim Hill, who's one of the most longtime broadcasters, former, I want to say he was a defensive back in the National Football League. I believe he played for the Detroit Lions. And so Jim Hill's been in the city forever, and he knows all these guys, and he was a fellow athlete, so he's accepted by them. And so as I started watching, I stayed on KCBS, which is where Jim Hill works, because I know that he's got these guys on speed dial on his cell phone. And so this is Jim Hill's interview with Jerry West.
I call him, if you're familiar with astrology, he's like that shining star. He can get you back. Discovered Kobe and Jerry West, and Jerry is with us right now. And Jerry, I appreciate you being here with us today, my friend, because I know this is a tough day for all of us, but especially for you, because you were the one that discovered Kobe.
Well, Jim, you know, I really didn't discover Kobe, okay? There was, you know, he was a great young high school player in that time. It wasn't in vogue to draft players like that. As I say, I was part of the process of getting here. His agent and Arne Tellem and myself were able to, working through the draft till he became a Laker. Those were very exciting moments for us to get a young, charismatic kid like him. But more importantly, a very unique talent. It was start of a long, I don't say process, but start of a long friendship and working relationship. To hear this news this morning, frankly, at first I was shocked. And then after a while, it's really sunk in. And, you know, to see the transformation of him from a 17-year-old kid who used to spend time at my house with me to my son Ryan driving him around because he couldn't drive. He couldn't even sign a contract because he was too young. To him, the constant questions about the NBA, wanting me to go to a gym with him to watch him work out and maybe make suggestions to him. It was more than, I really felt like a surrogate father to him. And then as his career blossomed and he started to establish this an enormous reputation as a player and also filled with accomplishments. But his charisma on top of it was something that most great players don't have, and he had it. But to wake up to this news, this has been one of the most horrible days of my life. I felt like I've lost a son, and frankly, not doing very well.
Yeah, Jerry, I know there's only a few people that have had a really intimate relationship with Kobe, and you are one of them because you were with him there through the good, the bad, and the indifferent.
Well, Jim, it wasn't all rosy. It never is, and particularly for someone like him who was so anxious for success. I remember there's one personal thing I remember. I said to him after a game where he played, and I said, "Man, you look a little tired tonight." And he said to me, he said, "I just proposed to my wife, to hopefully my new wife." And I'll never forget that moment. It was in the locker room right after a game. And, to see him get married, have children, and change a career so drastically to where he was making a difference in this world, not as an athlete, but as a very bright person. His interest in women, in terms of his basketball academy, the pride that he took into those things, and to see that all taken, and his family, my God, I there's going to have to be some really strong people out there supporting them, because this is the worst news you could ever get.
I know it's difficult, Jerry. You knew him better than anyone. And the other thing is, he came to you for advice, not only about basketball, but just about growing and maturing into a young man responsible to his family and to the community as well, didn't he?
Well, Jim, as I say, I don't want to go around saying that I was responsible for his life, period. I don't, because that would be grossly unfair. But the thing that I will share with you is how, to me, the things I saw him, the maturity that I saw him grow into, I saw him grow up. I saw him deal with, press that was negative at times because he played the game with a flair. And any time you play the game with a flair, you're susceptible to making mistakes. But I was his biggest supporter. But also, I had some very serious talks with him about how he needs to change his game a little bit to be able to accommodate himself with his other teammates. But I think the thing that brought me great joy was to watch him with his wife and his kids. It was truly inspiring for me to see this. He lived in a world of testosterone, okay, as all athletes do. And for him to be able to separate the athletic accomplishments with his personal accomplishments and the things that he was doing to have a successful career, this was a brilliant kid. This wasn't some athlete who just happened to be a great basketball player. He was more than that. And Jim, this is...
Yeah, I know,
Jim. It's going to take a long time for me to get over this one.
Jerry, why do you think he was still so beloved today, even though he's been out of the game for a couple of years?
Jim, I think players that play the game with a flair, okay, you see a lot of great players who, you know, look at Abdul-Jabbar's career, okay? And he just had a completely different personality. And you can arguably say he's the greatest career of anyone. But yet people, I don't think, will equate and look at him the same way they do as Irvin Johnson. He played the game with a flair. He had a great vibe with the fans. He still does. He's bigger than life. And Kobe's legacy, that it will remain forever. His impact will remain forever. And, but my God, I just feel so horrible for his family. Oh, my goodness.
And for as great a basketball player as he was, Jerry, and I've said many times, and I've heard you say it too, he was a better family man, a husband and father. Man, he loved those ladies in his home.
Well, as I say, all you had to do was see him with them. That's all you had to do. And I once kidded him one time when after he had a couple of girls, and again, I'm not someone who goes around and communicates with players, ex-players, okay? I don't think that's my position in this world. I just know the admiration that I have for the players that have really achieved something special, but sometimes the ones who haven't. But with him, as I say, he had a little extra gold dust sprinkled on him, and I was kidding him. I said, "You're not a man." I said, "You have all these women in your life." And, of course, he laughed at it. But to think that I won't see him, to think his family won't see him, people who loved him, people who admired him, it's just god-awful.
He was a gift, wasn't he, Jerry?
Jim, he was definitely a gift. Yes, he was. And as I say, you never know when a kid is born what it's going to be. And even though he was a son of a basketball player, it's hard to imagine his excellence, his... You know, people call it Mamba mentality. I don't. He was just born with an incredible desire to win, and it had nothing with his mentality. He just wanted to win at all costs, and he would win at all costs. He laid his life on the line every night when it came to winning. Losing was not in his vocabulary. And with a lot of great players, but he just had this persona that very few have, a lot desire, and a lot will never have, even though they've had great careers.
Now, the interesting thing is they've trimmed that interview. That interview goes on for maybe a half hour. And one of the interesting things Jerry West says in that is that it's one of the reasons that he struggles with God. And he said, you know, I grew up in West Virginia. And he said, we didn't have anything when I was a kid. We had nothing. He said, and the best person I know, I've ever known on this planet, was my older brother. He was a great, great guy, right? He helped provide for our family. You know, he was a leader at our church, and he said he was my older brother, and he went to Vietnam, and he was killed. And he said, and I know people aren't going to like when I say this. He said, but it's honestly how I feel. And I was honestly, I mean, I was like, holy shit, man. And I was wondering if they would leave that in the interview that ultimately did not air live. And so, that was probably the most pointed interview I heard yesterday. Magic Johnson also appeared and was on for, I don't know, 15 minutes. And again, it's they're interesting interviews because they know Jim Hill and they've been around each other for years and they're comfortable with each other. And so when these things happen, you know, it's kind of a unique look into their lives. So, yeah. So anyway, Kurt Knoll's going to join us here in a few minutes. The United States Marine Corps Band makes this morning official, although a bit jumbled. Good morning to you. Advertised. Kurt Knoll joins us, as he does on occasion. You all know, some of you know him as F-18 Man. So, Kurt, good morning. How are you doing?
Morning, Mac. How do you hear me?
The best I've ever heard you. We've never, you and I have never, I don't think we've ever done this Skype thing, so it's kind of cool. But you're a Skyper because you you wind up all over the world, and so with family, you're no stranger to Skype. So well done.
Hey, it sounds nice and clear on my end too. I hope I'm not how sometimes when you're on the phone, you start talking louder. So if I'm out of my element here with the network of Skype and the capability, just let me know because I don't want to blow away the system there, All Marine Radio.
You know how I work. I tend not to keep that shit a secret.
Yeah, that's very true. Very true. Powerful interview I was listening to with Jerry West this morning.
Man. Yeah, and then like I said, the part that they didn't leave in there is the part where he talks about his brother, his oldest brother, being killed in Vietnam. And also all of a sudden the interview, you can see, I mean, just it was so raw, you know, that Jerry West, you know, he'd seen Kobe Bryant right in the news as a kid growing up in Philadelphia playing basketball. He's phenomenal. And then it was this idea that, you know, he's going to be one of those guys who tries to make the jump straight from high school, hadn't been done very well before. And the Lakers wind up training for him, so he knows him, and he tells a story about his Jerry West kid driving Kobe Bryant around because doesn't have a driver's license, and he's only 17, so he can't sign his contract. You know, it's just crazy, and that's when he meets him. And then just for a guy like that, the devastating news that yesterday that, you know, he's dead. And so, no, it was probably the most – and you saw, I don't know for those of you that followed it throughout the course of the day, but you saw guys like Dwayne Wade, you know, I don't know how I would describe it. I mean, fighting off being distraught, right, knowing that, you know, millions of people are going to see what they put out, trying to – honor his memory, but right, absolutely devastated, right? And so it was. I mean, and again, here in Southern California, where we both live, I mean, the personal stories that people who showed up at not only the crash site, but you know, the Grammys are going on at Staples Center. You had all these Lakers fans, you know, showing up at Staples Center for their own little vigil. And these people are telling stories like, I grew up without a father. You know, my mom raised me. You know, we had a lot of trouble in the house. And, you know, and I used to watch Kobe Bryant. And I used to listen to what he said. And the reason I am what I am today is because of him. You know, and I saw another guy said, I got married on August 24th. His two numbers, 8-24, that were both retired by the Lakers because of what he means to me in my life. And you're sitting there watching this going, wow. Wow. So, anyway. But
yeah, well, you know, it's not funny, haha, but funny, ironic that Jerry West talked about him as a father because I actually – in a kind of, you know, had this impromptu interaction with him that was really powerful. And
Jerry West?
Kobe. Oh, no, Kobe Bryant.
Right.
And so what happened was, you know, being in the soccer, you know, kind of, you know, network that I'm in, and what happened was the U.S. soccer team, the women's national team, came to San Diego to play. And so we had, as most coaches do, kind of rallied the team and said, okay, let's go watch them play. And we're sitting there in the stands. And I'm not kidding. Like maybe 50 feet, 100 feet, not 100 feet, 50 feet in front of me. You know, and think of like groups of teams that are all sitting together. So it's like everyone has their own colors on and everything. Right. But around halftime, some commotion's going on in front of me, about maybe 50 feet in front of us, straight in front of us. And we look, and I'm kind of looking down there, like, what? Why is security like kind of having people move away from this area? And I realize it's Kobe Bryant. He's just sitting in the stands with all of us, like maybe, you know, I would consider to be like 10 rows in front of me. I'm like looking down on him, right? And so Sydney and I are sitting there next to each other, and we've got all the girls that all my daughter's teammates are all sitting together, and they don't even really know who he is, but we know who he is, obviously. But the thing that stood out to me, and Jerry West touched on it, was the whole second half, I'm kind of glancing down at him, and he's just hanging out with the team, and his daughter was on his lap almost the entire game, right? So he just was just holding her on his lap, and they were just watching the women's, you know, national soccer team play and just enjoying being there. And you know, he had all his daughter's teammates all with him and their families. And they're just sitting there with, as just being a dad, just a doting father, a doting dad. And Jerry West touched on it. Like, you know, as amazing athlete and basketball player he was, it's just, when it came down to it, he was just a leader and an amazing family man and father. And that was just, you know, example that I personally saw. That was, I'll never forget that, you know, just that here's this guy, he's just larger in life, and he's just sitting in the stands with all of us with his daughter on his lap, you know, and that was my interaction with Kobe Bryant. So,
well, you know, to me, you know, he believed in greatness, right? I mean, and one of the things I think is interesting, he's such an advocate for women's sports, right, and women's basketball. And he, yeah, in my opinion, right, he's going to blow up, you know, and support women's basketball because guess who's coming? His daughter's coming. And given her genetic background, you know, it's like, look, I'm not going to force this, but I'm going to create something that she's going to be one of a huge star in. And so to me, he was, you know, if you hear the stories about him as a businessman, his cultivation of all of this, you know, and helping so many people. And those are stories. I mean, it was interesting to hear Magic Johnson talk about the NBA today. He said, let me just tell you, the NBA today, these guys grew up, Kobe's their guy. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, guys who have aged out of the league grew up and watched Michael Jordan. They watch me and Larry Bird. He said the guys in the league today, he said Kobe's their guy.
Right.
And he was such a good dude. He would work out with them. He would offer them advice. That's why everybody's reacting the way they're reacting, because he was just too good of a dude. So it's real interesting. Now, he's always been an aviation guy. You know, he used to start flying himself, you know, from their home in Newport Coast to the Staples Center, fly himself to practice, you know, and it allowed him to have a family life and not have his family live in Los Angeles, allowed him not to have to sit in the car for hours and hours and hours in L.A. traffic and shit like that. Did you ever cross paths with him? Because you've worked out of Orange County Airport, John Wayne Airport, you know, off and on in your life. Did you ever cross paths with him relative to aviation?
I never saw him at John Wayne as much as I'm there and right. have been there, you know, over the years. I never saw him there, but there is a lot of celebrities. That's their kind of home field. Because if you look at it, really, it's John Wayne, it's Long Beach, and it's Santa Monica are kind of the three, you know, what I would consider to be like smaller airfields that surround LA that's, you know, very capable and they're used to handling those type of people. But, you know, you're not going to have the LAX traffic and not only aviation, but also from a ground movement. You know, it, you live right next to John Wayne. You know how easy it is to get in and out of there with a vehicle. It's just a snap, right? And so imagine just pulling up to your literally when those, you know, if you take a step back, like his helicopter, if you think of the interior, looks like a first class limousine. You know, that's what they're decked out nice and lots of real comfy seats in the back. And you figure they're just pulling up in their vehicle and they literally pull up, you know, plane side or helicopter side. Somebody gets in their vehicle, valets it for them. They take 10 steps. They're inside the helicopter and they're taxiing out and 30 seconds, you know, 1 minute, you know, and that's at my corporate aviation side. That was my goal was packs and pull up. Hey, does anyone need to use the restroom? Nope. Okay. Let's go. Bags are in. Everybody's accounted for. Hit the start button and we're moving, you know, try to be underway in 5 minutes. Cause that's what they pay you to do, right. Is to keep them on time. And that's why they pay the big money for those type of assets is for the efficiency. And just like you said, the flexibility of being able to move around freely with types of assets like helicopters and private jets. And I've, you know, been obviously a part of that lifestyle and that culture and that community.
All right. I want to kind of walk through yesterday. I think that, you know, if, you know, one of the things when these things happen, you know, for those of us who have been around aviation, you professionally, me simply riding in the back, but, you know, spending a lot of time in helicopters, you know, you begin to look and you see things. And so I wanted to have you on today and do something that we do at times, unfortunately, and that is explain things or you to say, yeah, I don't understand that. So talk to us about visibility and getting in the air and flight planning and things like that. It looked like the flight plan with the, you know, the helicopter, it's a dual engine, you know, as you described it, limousine, right? Then and very, very, you know, how did I see it called? It's a very celebrity friendly aircraft. It's a dual engine Sikorsky. Can you describe have you looked at the helicopter at all?
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, as a matter of fact, the Coast Guard flies it. I mean, it's a very capable airplane. It's a Sikorsky and they've been around for many, many years, very well known, very reputable. And it's a very common helicopter. It's definitely, I would consider it like a higher end, like you said, dual engine, very capable type of aircraft. And when a dual engine aircraft, and when I say aircraft, I'm talking not only fixed wing, but helicopter, the flexibility of a dual engine or even a triple engine or quad engine, you know, like 747, is you lose one engine, right? You can still be able to fly. And the question is, you know, if it was a mechanical issue and they lost one engine, did they still have enough what we would consider in the aviation industry to be like thrust or power to still generate lift, right? So that's, they're going to look at all that and analyze that. But talking about the visibility and what you talked about earlier was, obviously yesterday was a very foggy, uncharacteristic kind of day here in Southern California.
And, and explain that, because, you know, normal in Southern California is, you know, coastal fog and overcast burning off by what, mid-morning?
Right? Yeah, like 8 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
And 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, and then clear skies throughout, and then the shit comes back. I mean, that's yesterday, none of that. It stayed.
No, it was hanging in there quite a bit. And, you know, actually, I was driving up to Pomona for the Grand National Roadster Show, and even my son goes, "Boy, it's sure foggy today." Like it was just, right. just this kind of real heavy fog outside yesterday in Southern California.
And when you're talking about Pomona, right, after you hit Pomona, right, you hit St. Louis. That's how east that is. I mean, it's not like
it
right,
was still it, fog. Yeah,
yeah, it's heavy. Not. It's not yeah. like it's. We're talking about coastal fog here. So anyway, keep going.
So now. I you've analyzed the tapes. I've had a chance to look at the tapes. So, you know, first of all, let's back up one step of that, you know, kind of the report that's coming out that the Los Angeles, you know, Sheriff's Department, who actually flies out of John Wayne Airport, because I've actually parked right next to them where they park. So I know exactly their helicopters and they fly Bell helicopters or like they look like Hueys, like what you and I have flown on. And they were right there at John Wayne. To say that, well, they grounded their flight ops. Well, that's not – that really shouldn't be brought into this lane because what's their mission, right? Their mission is air-to-ground reconnaissance, right? So if you can't see the ground because of the fog or the cloud layer and you're airborne, then why are we flying this mission today? Like let's wait until it burns off. Then we can actually utilize this asset appropriately, get airborne – and we can now do air to ground reconnaissance. That's what those assets are doing. So the fact that people are bringing this up that, well, the LA County Sheriff didn't even fly. It's like they weren't flying. Well, their mission isn't troop transport. They're not going from A to B like Kobe's pilot was doing that day. So that's people trying to grasp to the why, right? Which is not factual and it's not even the same mission. If Kobe's pilot was being contracted that day to do air-to-ground reconnaissance and he was flying, then I'd be questioning why the heck was he flying. So that should be flushed. The second thing about – we talk about visibility. Well, he took off and you have what's called visual flight rules and instrument flight rules, right? So if you are below a certain amount of visibility and there's rules. It's, you know, if you cloud layer, it's 500 feet below, 1,000 feet above – 2,000 feet laterally, and 3 miles visibility. If you have that criteria as be reported either by the ground or if it's not a ground facility available by you and as a pilot, if you have that criteria, you are approved to fly visual flight rules, which essentially see and avoid, right? You are as long as you're not going to fly into controlled airspace, that they're like cylinders out there of controlled airspace, primarily over airports or military operating areas. As long as you avoid those areas, restricted areas, airports, you are approved to fly pretty much wherever you want to fly, right? As long as you have the weather requirements. Yesterday was those requirements were not there, right? So he did not file or fly, it was a true VFR flight. So he was not VFR, visual flight rules. So then to get around that, we have what's called instrument flight rules. And instrument flight rules, your weather, it can be all the way down to dang near 0-0, right? And you can take off and you can land, but you have to have not only the capabilities in the airplane, but the capabilities with air traffic control. And you have to follow very specific flight rules, right? Almost like think of like roads in the sky. So, and they are literally like called jetways or airways. Right. So, or we can do as technology has improved, we can do what's waypoint to waypoint navigation, which is what most airlines do now, right? They do some jetways, but they also do waypoint to waypoint navigation. What's important about that is he didn't use an IFR flight plan. So then you're like, okay, well, Kurt, you're telling me he didn't go out VFR. He didn't go out IFR. What did he do? Well, he did a technique or a procedure that's called special VFR. And special VFR is essentially I don't have VFR, but I don't want to fly. I don't want to file IFR because where I'm going is basically a place that's not going to be able to give me an instrument approach, or the weather's going to be good enough where I can see and come in there visually. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say to you, I will stay above the clouds. I will not penetrate any airspace that I'm not approved into, and I will make sure that I have the appropriate amount of visibility. Now in fixed wing, It's, I believe, a mile and a half or 1 mile. I think it's 1 mile. It, again, special VFR is not used very much in fixed wing pilots, but I think helicopters use it a lot. A helicopter, the visibility is a half mile, right? So they don't have to see very far. And as long as they're above the clouds and they can see basically around them, they're approved to file what's called a special VFR. And that's what he did, right?
All right.
So now you're starting to say, okay, Kurt, let's start looking at all the different things that were kind of stacked against him. Or as we talk in naval aviation, the Swiss cheese model, right? So first of all,
Explain the Swiss cheese model. When and so I
The
first
Swiss
heard
cheese
this.
model is when think of every situation that you're looking at in this flight today is a slice of Swiss cheese. And as those slices begin to line up and you can see through the Swiss cheese, see through the holes, that's when things start happening that should not happen, i.e. a mishap.
Okay,
So your job is to pull it apart.
The Swiss cheese, though, is predominantly solid, right? But there is a hole, and when there's a hole in every piece of Swiss cheese, and you layer those things together, and because of fate or divine intervention or however it lines up, those holes line up, right? Low
That's right.
probability, multiple factors, but they all line up. That's the Swiss cheese model, yeah?
Now, you touched on this earlier, but I'm going to just break it down a little simpler. The Swiss cheese yesterday, right? We just talked about it. Fog, so low, I would say lower visibility. Obviously, weather was a factor, right? So that's a Swiss cheese,
Right.
right? He's flying a helicopter, right? So you're low altitude, right? So your margin for error is much lower when you're flying lower to the ground, right? Just think of seconds to impact, vice minutes or whatever the case may be. So he's flying a low altitude aircraft. There's another causal factor. It's a VIP flight, right? What I would consider very important people. There's the pressure to perform. The VIP is also the bill payer, right? So there is a pressure there that you need to accomplish this mission. The third causal factor, they were going up to, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'm seeing is they were going up to Kobe Bryant's training facility, the Black Mamba Academy. Isn't that correct? Is where they were supposed to end up?
Yes.
So is that a controlled airport? No. So they're going in from controlled airspace to non-controlled airspace, i.e., you're not being radar controlled by the air traffic control. You're not within radio contact. As you start to get lower, because remember, radios, as simple as they are, even in aviation, it's line of sight, right? So the higher you go, the better reception you have. The lower you go, if anything gets in the way of those antennas, it's gonna sever the tie, and you're not gonna be able to communicate. And we saw that yesterday in the tapes, is they start losing communication with the pilots as he's descending towards the Black Mamba training facility, right? Another causal factor. So also, I would say they had multiple people on board. There's nine people. Now, this airplane, I'm not sure what the max capability was. I've seen anything from 8 to 14, depending on the seating configuration. But people in aviation, that's weight, right? So you're now, if there's nine people on board, which is what I'm hearing is how many were on board with the pilot. Okay, so nine people, and we usually just round up to, with bags, 200 pounds a person, right? So you got 18, almost 2,000 pounds of people on board slash gear. That could be a factor, right? If you lose an engine, do you have the thrust or the power to still maintain flight if you start having mechanical issues, right? So you're low altitude, you've got fog, you've got a VIP that you feel pressure to perform. You also have a lot of people on board. To me, as a pilot, when I flew families, I always had a little bit of a, I've got kids on board. Like, I always felt a little more responsibility for that, like a little more pressure. So, and you touched on it too, Mac. We don't know this, who was sitting where. There's a chance Kobe was up front, right? But another big one is he was single pilot, right? So there is a lot to be said when you're flying single pilot, and I have done it multiple times, especially these VIP flights, and you are single pilot, weather is low, you've got pressure, and now he's low altitude. Do you see the Swiss cheese starting to line up here? Yeah. Like, so now all of a sudden he's got a mechanical issue. Maybe we're just throwing it out there, and he's low altitude. You've got seconds to make a decision. Or was he disoriented? You know, we just don't know, right? But there is a lot that went into all that yesterday. That was the Swiss cheese. We, as sad as it is and as awful as it is, that was the Swiss cheese model lining up yesterday.
Talk to me about when you see the flight plan, right? If he was just going to Thousand Oaks, right, the shortest distance is right out over the water and in from the west.
Yeah, but you got LAX airspace right there, right?
So you can't do that.
Easier thing to do, which I've done it, is you go around to the east and you come around the backside.
Got it.
And that was all very standard and normal. And he did exactly what he should do. It all felt very normal to me. What I kind of started doing, the sucking T sound, you know, as you kind of start listening to tapes, was, I don't know if you heard it, but the one tower was talking about, they just had a citation go around. Did you hear that? Did you hear that, Calm?
No, I didn't listen to the tapes.
So there is one of the radio recordings as the tower is talking. So we call it tower to tower, right? As he's transitioning through airspace up through LA, he's basically going from one tower controlled airspace to another one, because obviously you've got Van Nuys there, you've got Burbank there, and then he's proceeding over to the west towards Thousand Oaks. Well, as he gets up there, they're trying to get airplanes in on instrument arrivals or instrument approaches, and that's why they were holding, because they couldn't clear him through.
Got it.
The space. That's why he was holding, right? And they just said to him, if you listen to it, we just had a citation go around. Which, why would a citation go around? Well, because he didn't break out. He couldn't see the runway, right? So then I'm starting to think, like, wow, what was the weather up there? It must have been pretty low if you're telling me a jet went around I don't know if it was Burbank or Van Nuys. I think it was Van Nuys. Anyways, so weather's low, right? And the citation goes around. They're trying to get airplanes in on instrument approaches, and they're holding them out there to the east. And then they said, okay, we've got separation. You're approved through, continue west. Also, which is very common for helicopters, you hear them talk about how are you navigating? And he's like, I'm going to follow this road, right? So in helicopter speak, they call it IFR, which is I follow roads. It's kind of a tongue in cheek thing, because they don't really, you know, they don't fly instrument flight rules. They file I follow roads.
Right.
It's kind of a sarcastic thing and a joke in the aviation industry. But it's true in this case that he was following roads. If you listen to him, hey, I'm going to proceed up this highway, then I'm going to move west along this highway. And then the tower goes, okay, I know what you're doing. Pretty standard. You're going to follow this highway over, and that's how you're going to proceed towards Thousand Oaks. I got it. All right. They're like, okay, I know what you're doing.
Okay. So I just want to go just real quick. So he goes north and he follows the 118, which kind of runs east-west along the northern rim of the San Fernando Valley. But here's my question for you when you follow the track. The 118 then comes back south and connects to the 101, right? Where they crash in Calabasas is nowhere near Thousand Oaks. So is he?
But so, I think he was. So I think and that let me, if you let look me, at the track, though. Go ahead. No, you talk. You
okay.
Talk.
No, well, let me just. And one more thing that I want you. So and then, but the one of the things I read is the tower says you're too low, right? Not, and I guess it means that there I can't give you directions because I'm not seeing you on. I'm not seeing your track because you're too low. Could you explain that to us, right?
Well, because see, the lower you go, the harder it is for them to communicate,
right.
And it's also they can't. You could lose a radar track, right? Because their radar antennas can. The lower you are, you know, and we use it in a tactic in the military was we mask ourselves behind terrain, right? So you fly these low level inserts, these low level routes. And you literally are hugging the terrain because the radar can't pick you up. The terrain is interfering with their ability to see you with their radar. The same way as the terrain is interfering with their ability to communicate with you. So what the tower is telling him, or whoever the controller was telling him, was, hey, you're too low. Like, I'm having trouble talking to you. I'm having trouble seeing you. That's where that's what's going on.
Okay. Talk to me about if you're flying by iFollow roads and visibility is intermittent and they're making good progress and the 118 now starts to come south and you're back into that soup again. Why would they not have just, could he have continued if it was clear further north along the, you know, those mountains, there's a pass, you know, in the San Fernando Valley, right? And it goes from the San Fernando Valley into the Conejo Valley, which is where Thousand Oaks is. And the 118 comes down south. Why would he not fly over the mountains and come into the Thousand Oaks from the northeast as opposed to going south where they ultimately wound up? Is there any aviation reason that you can think of why he would do that?
The only thing I could think is that was a familiar route. They were familiar with that kind of that course line or that track.
Right.
And, you know, familiarity brings comfort, right? It's kind of like driving the same way you drive home, right? It's like, I usually take the same way. Well, same thing in aviation. Usually you follow the same kind of route and they're going obviously to a familiar place. It was Kobe Bryant's training academy. So that was probably a pretty standard way. And also remember, the visibility doesn't have to be from your airplane down. It has to be horizontal,
right?
So he doesn't have to maintain contact with the road the entire time. As long as they have a general, you know, proximity to that road, they can follow the roads, you know, and I know where I am and it's in between this valley and there's that peak over there and there's that peak there. And we're kind of halfway between the peaks and that's the roads, you know, in the middle of the peaks. That's acceptable as long as you have the horizontal visibility. That was fine. It, is this ideal? Absolutely not. It's absolutely not ideal, but it's not illegal what he was doing. Like, it wasn't like this guy's out showboating and doing something he shouldn't have been doing. Like, a special VFR, again, it's the Swiss cheese. Like, he's below minimums for a VFR flight, and he didn't file an IFR flight because they're basically going up to Kobe Bryant's training facility that I'm assuming has a helicopter pad on top of the building or in the parking lot, or maybe out, you know, has its own pad like away from the parking lot. But regardless, it's not like you're going to a controlled tower. So you can't really file an IFR flight plan all the way to touchdown at that facility. But he could have filed an IFR flight plan close. But if he's got the weather minimums and he's like, look, we can do the special VFR. I'm comfortable. We've done this flight 500 times. Right. I'm very familiar with this. You know, he hopefully kind of what we call ORM this, like, you know, operational risk management, like, okay, I think we can do this safely and in a way they win. But you've got to realize that the Swiss cheese begins to line up. And like we've anchored on before, is how many different slices of Swiss cheese were against them yesterday? A lot, right? They had a lot going on. And then now add possibly, and I underline possibly, some type of mechanical issue, right? So now you're trying to troubleshoot your low altitude. You're having trouble maintaining contact with the ground. You're having trouble communicating. You're having trouble with maintaining radar contact. You know, do you see where I'm going with this? Like, it's the Swiss cheese is lining up, right? So
let me read you
room for error in helicopters is very small.
Right. Let me read you an email, Mac. First of all, I really enjoy when you all do this because, like you all, we have so many questions, and most of the things I read aren't very good. So I just want to thank F-18 man, and also, I think you've had Joey Perazzo, not sure if I'm spelling that right, on to do the same thing. And it's always really helpful for us who try to understand. My question involves the altitude when they impact. It seems awfully low. What do you think, that he dropped down because he couldn't see a landmark and was looking for something? Why would they be flying at such a low level? One of the interviews I saw from somebody who lived in one of the homes said that the home vibrated as the helicopter passed over, assuming that there was no mechanical issues and that Kobe's former pilot was right, that they probably had at least one good engine. Why would they be down that level?
Well, so here's the thing, right? You got nine people on board,
Right.
and lift is generated by, lift and weight are basically, that's the opposite of lift is weight, right? So in order to generate more lift, we need more energy, right? So in this case is, let's just say hypothetically they lost an engine, right? So now their single engine or one of the engines is having issues and it's not generating the power. Well, you can't maintain the altitude. So the only option you have is to go down,
Right.
right? Which is very standard, right? If in big aircraft and Airbus 320s, 777s, if you lose an engine, we factor in what's called a drift down altitude. So it's, what do I need to drift down to? What do I need to, quote unquote, glide down to where the airplane can still fly safely and has enough energy, single engine. And for most airplanes, like in the commercial aviation side, it's about 20, mid 20s, right? 24 or 26,000 feet. So let's say you're cruising on at 39,000 feet and you lose an engine. They're going to drift down because they can't maintain that altitude. They don't have the thrust to maintain that. They don't have the energy to maintain altitude. So they have to trade kinetic energy with, and now they've gone to potential energy, which is altitude. So they have to trade potential energy for more kinetic energy. So they have to descend. So by descending using potential energy, they're descending down to where they can get enough thrust at a lower altitude with a single engine. In this case, it's the same philosophy in helicopter flying. If they had a mechanical issue where they were now down to limited power or one engine, there is a chance that they didn't have enough thrust to maintain that altitude and they had to start descending. And maybe even he was looking at somewhere to land. It could have been so bad that they were having issues where they're like, the thing about a helicopter is you can land anywhere, right? They've landed in parking lots, right? And heck, little Cessnas land on I-5 all the time.
Right.
So, once it feels like once every couple of years, if somebody lands. We just had one like a couple months ago land on I-5 right by our house. And I say that because small planes and helicopters don't need a lot of space to land. And beaches are great and roads are great. And for helicopters, parking lots are great or open fields. So that could have been a case that he's like, look, we are having issues and we need to land now. And they're starting their descent, right? So I know there is some, and I have not seen this, but I've just heard through the chatterboxes that there's a radio call from ATC saying you're too low. Well, again, aviate, navigate, communicate is the order that all aviators use as priority, right? The first thing you do is fly the aircraft, aviate. The next thing you do is navigate. Like we point the airplane or the aircraft in where we want to go, and we fly it in that direction. What's the last thing we do? Communicate, right? Aviate, navigate, communicate in that order. So if this pilot is got his hands full, he's got possibly mechanical issues. Weather's low. We just talked about that. There's special VFR. He's in kind of a rising terrain, kind of coming through valleys of Thousand Oaks. More, that's another Swiss cheese model.
Right.
Is its terrain is a factor. And now you got ATC barking at you like, hey, what are you doing? You're too low. It's like if my bucket's full, I'm not even gonna talk to them. I'm not even gonna respond. It's like I'm trying to fly this plane and manage it appropriately. So you have to prioritize and compartmentalize, and you need to aviate, navigate, and communicate in that order. So that could be why they weren't communicating back to ATC. They also were low altitude, so their line of sight was a factor. They also had what I would consider to be a high workload going on with the weather. So there's a lot of different Swiss cheeses line up on this situation.
What about their airspeed? 160 knots estimated at the time of impact, according to, it's amazing. I said this earlier, but within, the hour, right? You're seeing the track because it's all tracked by satellites and it's all recorded digitally, right? Whether we're talking about the USS McCain, the USS Fitzgerald, or the or Kobe's flight. All of a sudden, boom, the track goes up, digitally displayed on here's what time they took off, this is where they went, this is what they did, you know, all of that. It's amazing, you know, how connected the planet is, and how fast, you know, this stuff.
Well,
gets
and how public accessible.
Oh, man. Yeah.
It is. You can look up, you know, the N number, which is like, think of your license plate number. The N number is painted on the back of every plane's tail, no matter if it's for an airline or for a little, you know, helicopter, a little general aviation. That license plate, the N number, is on the back of every tail, and you can go in about 2 seconds and look it up on the line, and you can see who owns it and where it's operated out of and everything, right? It's very public.
Right, right. Because, once again, using the public airspace, right?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about...
Now, I will say, but answer your question from the inquiry, though, if you look at it from this perspective, right, is what the impact, the speed of the impact, right? That's a very important point you bring up, okay? So let's look at the why. Why would they be going like what I would consider to be cruise speed at impact, right? Well, the first thing is think of like an attack run, a strafing run that we do in tactical aviation, right? And they never pull up. It's called controlled flight into terrain. Like if you impact the ground at essentially the same speed that your attack run is set, then that's controlled flight into terrain, right? You didn't recognize there was terrain there. You never pulled up, or maybe you pulled at the last second, right? So that would be the situation here is, was it controlled flight into terrain? Was it so low in fog, which I don't think it was? Was it so low and did they actually go into weather and they couldn't see the rising terrain? I don't think that was the case, right? So, you know, my hunch is we X that off, that there was controlled flight into the terrain. They just didn't see the terrain. They didn't know the terrain was there and they ran into terrain. I would say you could probably scratch that, but I could be wrong, right?
Well, I'll tell you what, because that's what a lot of people who lived in the area said. It was foggier than it ever is around here, right?
And, yeah, it was foggy. Right. But also in that type of aircraft, I'm assuming they had GPWS, which is the ground proximity warming system, right? So think of it as radar mapping in your plane, and you can see the terrain. And actually, as you get close, it'll say, whoop, whoop, pull up, whoop, whoop, pull up. You know, it'll tell you too low terrain. Pull up, and it'll give you a warning.
And it does It does that before you get there, right?
Absolutely. It gives you time to react. I think it's like 5 seconds or something.
And you're also, and the other thing is, you're also watching on GPS. I would imagine, right? At some place in the cockpit.
Oh yeah, they've got a moving map, and so they're right. And he had all that plotted. The route was all plotted. Everything was. He's following the map. So again, that was I'm saying he I'm the pilot I'm assuming
was
had it plotted
right
I'm assuming I don't know for sure but I'm assuming it's all plotted so let's look at controlled flight and terrain. If they didn't see the terrain and they just flew into the hill or flew into the, that would be a reason to impact at cruise speed, right? 155-160 knots, which is about what I think what the Sikorsky flew at.
Right.
The other question is, well, why didn't they slow down? If you're telling me they're descending and they're at cruise speed, then why weren't they slowing down? Well, how does a helicopter slow down? It changes its pitch, right? It's like they pulled a collective to change the pitch to slow the airplane down.
Can you explain change the pitch for people that aren't familiar with the term?
So there's pitch and power in a helicopter, right? And as those rotors are spinning, they can only spin so fast before they get just prior to supersonic, right? Because what happens when it hits supersonic, you would say, oh, let's move them faster. Well, they are moving about as fast as they can possibly move. But the moment they hit supersonic, they self-destruct, right? So that you can't break the sound barrier on the tips of those helicopter blades. So they move them as fast as they can, but in order to generate lift, they change the pitch. So just like the pitch on a propeller of a boat, well, this has a variable pitch that they can actually, they're actually twisting and they're pulling, twisting with power and are pulling with a lever to generate pitch, taking a bigger bite out of the air, right?
So the blade is actually rotating or moving, right, to do what the pilot is requesting, yes?
That's right. It's okay. Changing. It's taking either a more or less bite of the air, right?
Okay, now let me ask you one other thing. The other thing that moves relative to moving the aircraft is the whole head of the rotor.
That's the rotor. That's the rotor.
Top, that head, that mast, right?
Yeah.
That thing.
That's what makes it go forward, back, side to side.
Okay.
That's right.
All right. So those are the two things in my grunt understanding of aviation. When you talk about, you know, the way these things do move and the apparatus that make them move, you know, you have the movement, you know, of the masthead, and then you have the movement of the pitch of the blades.
That's
which
right.
Accounts for,
well, you know, and you've heard this many times, and I think it's one of the coolest sounds. You know, back when the CH-46 was flying, you had the two big, you know, blades, the big rotors up there,
right.
And on those cold mornings where the air is kind of thick, and you could, and they had this, they were the full thrust, you know, full thrust. They had the lean, they were full pitch forward. They were taking the most bite out of the air, and you just hear them like whap, 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 whap. I mean, it just, the blade was just trying to take as much bite of the air as it could. And it was just the coolest sound.
Yeah.
That's what that is, right? It's grabbing as much air as it can and generating as much power to try to propel the aircraft through. So there's a lot of mechanical components about in a helicopter. The rotor is changing its direction, right? Forward, back, side to side. You've got the blades are actually changing their pitch to generate how much lift, right? And then the power, the more bite of the air, it causes more torque, which requires more power. So then you have to increase your power. So what is two-hand flying when you're flying a helicopter, like it is no joke. Like it's a handful. And plus you got your rudders, right? So your feet are moving the back part of the helicopter, which is the tail rotor, and that's in the yaw, right? So it's swinging the tail around, you know, side to side. So it is true three-axis flying, and it can get very, it's one of those components fails, it can be, no kidding, and this isn't a joke, no kidding, a handful. Like it can be, and especially now, again, the Swiss cheese, right? Weather's not good. They're down low. I would consider they were heavy, right? They had a lot of people on board. You know, you've got that Swiss cheese model is lining up. So,
okay. Now I want you to finish your thought about, you talked about if they didn't, you know, if they didn't simply drive it into the ground because of poor visibility and lack of situational awareness, you were going to make a subsequent point to that. What was that point?
Then why wouldn't they have flared?
Right.
Right. Because here's the thing is, so this is going to be, I'm actually just so glad you brought this up. Because I get this question all the time from my kids. What happens if a single engine helicopter or all the engines stop? How does it land? Does it just fall like a brick, right? No, is the answer. It does not do that. What they do is they do a technique that's called auto-rotate. So what they do essentially is, as simple as terms I can make it is, your engine fails in your car on the freeway, you throw it in neutral, right? And then when you get ready to stop, okay, there's the place, there's safe area I want to pull over. Then you apply your brakes, right? And you bring the car to stop. The helicopter works exactly the same way. They throw it in neutral, what they call, they fair the blades, and the aircraft just starts to fall, free fall, right? But the blades are still spinning. And then what's the art of a really good helicopter pilot, and what they train for all the time in the military, practices it constantly, is they auto rotate. So they allow the airplane just to fall, like, you know, back when we were kids, we'd throw that little, that pin, memory, right. We had look like a pencil and a little blade on top, and it would just fall down. Right before it gets to the ground, they yank the collective. They grab as much air as they can to cushion the landing. And literally they can do it. They can land it. And some people have done it to where the people in the back don't even know that they had an engine out, right? If they do it right, they can bring it in, it'll auto rotate down. And at the last second, in the last couple of seconds, they know exactly how much energy they're, how much fast they're coming in. And then they'll pull the collective. It'll grab a whole bunch of air. but it's one shot, one kill. Like, it's not like you, if you punt it, you're screwed. Like, if you yank too early, well, you just stop yourself, you know, 100 feet above the ground, but then the airplane's going to start to fall again, right? If you stop too late, well, then, you know, you yank the collective too late, it's going to impact the ground and you never slow down. So the art of it is finding that sweet spot of auto-rotating and pulling the collective enough to where you're grabbing enough air to slow the descent and you're able to land, but not so hard that you hurt yourself or the aircraft. But you've got to do it at the right time, because if your timing's off, you could put yourself in that corner and you can't get out of it. Right. So 155 mile an hour or knots. I don't know, I'm sure what it was, but anyways.
161, I think is what I read.
Is that knots or miles an hour?
I want to say it was knots.
Okay. Yeah, which is what aviation, we use knots. So let's just say he's doing 160 knots, right? At impact. Well, then why didn't they auto rotate? If you were auto rotating, Mac, they would have been doing 40, right? It would have been a smooth stop, and they would have cushioned the landing at the end. Why didn't they auto rotate?
Right. Why would you reject that he just flew it a controlled? What do you call that?
Controlled flight into terrain. It's called CFIT. Controlled flight into terrain.
So why? What makes you reject CFIT, given the speed of the aircraft?
I'm not rejecting it. Okay. I'm just saying that I would be surprised, because it was daytime.
Right.
So nighttime, maybe. But daytime, they should be special VFR, which, remember, we talked about it, is you should be able to at least see a half mile in a helicopter. What I'm seeing in the reports is it was about a mile visibility. So vertically a mile. So you're telling me that you can't, you know, a mile away, you can't see the hill, right? That would be, right. They would not, if he was less than that, and he was, let's just say, hypothetically speaking, they were in the clouds.
Okay.
Then is he special VFR anymore? No, he should be on an IFR flight plan. Cause you can fly all day IFR. You can fly in the clouds all day, but you got to be on an IFR flight plan, which IFR means you're under air ATC controlled. You're flying either point to point with waypoints or on an airway or a jetway, and the air traffic control is tracking you exactly where you're going, right? And that's what all the airlines, they're always under IFR flight rules. Right. Like, from whether it's a beautiful day out or not, we fly IFR, right? So
right. The it would seem to me, and again, this is stupid guy aviation stuff, right? Questions for you, but it would seem to me. You know, Thousand Oaks is they're still a ways away from Thousand Oaks. Again, unless they're following the 118, and why wouldn't you just go? You know, is there a ceiling that they can fly to relative to elevation under those rules? And why wouldn't you just, you know, go higher and then deal with whatever you need to deal with? Because again, you have GPS, right? You have all that stuff going on in the cockpit. Why wouldn't you just fly above that stuff till you get to Thousand Oaks and then figure it out when you got to Thousand Oaks?
Okay. So you just brought up a really good point. There is a word in aviation that essentially says all rules are thrown out and you can do whatever you need to do to land that plane.
Okay.
And the word is, I'm an emergency aircraft, or mayday, 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 right? If you say I'm an emergency aircraft, all rules are out the window. Put them in the trash, throw them away. It's whatever is the safest way for you to aviate, navigate, and communicate. It is now, that is the only thing you need to worry about, right? So I bring that up is, why didn't he climb? Well, if you look at the LAX airspace up to where they are, so airspace is built like an upside down wedding cake, right? Okay. And the closer you get to the airport, then it gets all the way down to the surface. But as you move away from the airport, then the upside down wedding cake is, if you think of it, is you're now you have room between the surface of the ground up to a certain altitude. And then as you get even further away from the airport, you have even higher above the ground up to a certain altitude. So think of an upside down wedding cake as Class B airspace,
Got it.
right?
Right.
Now, what's Class B airspace right where about where they were flying? LAX. LAX is right there, right? It's not far away from them, right? So they are, he's trying to not interfere with Class B airspace. So they're flying VFR flight rules near north side of LAX, right? So he's got to stay away from LAX airspace. So there could have been a shelf, and I'm looking at it right now, I'll see. There could have been a shelf near where they were at that prevented them from flying higher.
Got it.
But what's the key word? If they had issues, you can declare an emergency and you can do whatever you wanted to do, right? So I'm looking at a chart right now. There's Camarillo right there. Okay.
Which is where they were headed.
They were outside of Class B airspace. I'm looking at it right now.
So then
Now
there's.
they did have Point Mugu Naval Air Station, which was right near them. They could have gone into there as an emergency. You can go anything you want if you're emergency, right?
Right.
But you know what? Camarillo, I've actually flown in there. It's a neat airport. And they've got instrument approaches. They've got, you know, that could have been, maybe they were heading to Camarillo. I don't know. You know, that would have been a good option if they had issues. Let's just head to Camarillo and not worry about going to Black Mamba. You know, I don't know what they were doing. So,
Here's an
but.
email. Mac, I'm not sure if I missed anything. Was there anything transmitted in any of the transmissions that said they had any kind of issue on board?
Nothing I've seen.
Got
Nothing I've seen.
it. Okay.
Yeah.
All
Yeah.
right. All right. The
So, but then what's
so
concerning,
I let me
you will have a CVR though. Remember, you can have a
hold on,
cockpit
hold on.
voice
Let me, let,
recorder
I
on
just want to
board.
go back to the altitude thing. So because they're outside of Class B airspace, right? So if for those of you, if you close your eyes, LAX, you know where the big buildings are of LA? Okay, if you're looking at them from the south, okay, to the left and towards you, that's where LAX is, right? North of LAX is Santa Monica, and then as you go west, there's the mountains, right? And Malibu. On the other side of those mountains is Calabasas, okay? Further to the left and further north is Thousand Oaks, Camarillo, Santa Barbara, Point Mugu, and all the rest of that stuff. So he's out of Class B airspace, then he could have just gone up in altitude and dealt with it, because there's no reason for him to crash in Calabasas, is my point. If he had the ability to go up and then close on Thousand Oaks and then figure it out when he got to Thousand Oaks. Right? So to me, the reason he's in Calabasas is he's following the 118 as it gets to the 101, and then they're going to follow the 101 to Thousand Oaks. Otherwise, if there's no limit to him going further up, and I'm not a helicopter pilot, I'm just playing one on the radio. It doesn't like why the crash in Calabasas? I don't get it.
But
Why were they
what is
headed?
it?
Why were they
What
headed?
is it?
And they were headed south at the time of the crash, right?
Well, again, he's maybe that was a familiar way they
Right.
approached the Black Mamba training facility. This is maybe a familiar route. Like I'm looking at it right now. They were on the 101, right? Is that about where they were following?
Well, I thought no, I thought it was the 118, and then they came south as the 118 kind of goes into the you can the map I sent you, right? You can see on that track that they right they go to the northern end of the LA Basin, and then they head south. And they're trying to head west, right? Essentially going through a pass where Calabasas is, and then they hit the they he flies it into again, and that's where the crash occurs.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at your map chip, and I'm looking at a VFR chart. I can quickly figure out what they were doing. Well, you know, again, if you look at my chart, you have rising terrain to the northwest, right? So he's kind of following a valley along down towards the Black Mamba training facility. I would say familiarity was probably a factor, but also remember we talked about this earlier is what gets you altitude is energy, right? Well, to generate energy, you need thrust to transfer to lift to get you higher. and they might have had some mechanical issues. I would normally, though, it would surprise me that something wasn't transmitted mechanically. That hey, I can't remember what it's called, saying November Echoes. What was it? It was Echo Zoom X-ray or
November
something like that.
72 X-ray, Echo X-ray.
Was it 72 X-ray or something like that? What is it again, Mac?
Yeah, 72, November 72 Echo X-ray.
X-ray, right?
Right.
72 November 72 November 72 Echo X-ray is having, we're having oil pressure fluctuations. We're proceeding to the south. We'll report if we need any further assistance. The next thing they're going to say is, Roger 72, what is it? November 72 X-ray Echo X-ray, one able state souls on boards, fuel remaining, and intentions. Right? They're gonna start pulling you from information and say, we need to know how long you can stay airborne and how many people you are on board. Why? Because they need to know for the emergency crews of what they're dealing with for what they need for assets to help you, right? So they want you to know how much fuel on board you have, like how long you can stay airborne, and how many souls are on board. That's the first two radio comms that come out. Then you start coordinating with them. Hey, we're having oil pressure fluctuations. We're proceeding to the Ventura Airport. We need to pick up an IFR approach. Give me weather NOTAMs into Ventura. And then they'll give you the weather, the NOTAMs, boom, boom, boom. NOTAMs is notice airmen's, like, what's the conditions at the airport? Yep, weather looks good. We're going to proceed inbound. We're going to shoot an approach into Ventura. I'm just chairifying some situations of what you would do if you had start having mechanical issues. What I'm concerned though is if the point of impact shows that their velocity was 160 knots, the big question is why, right? It's usually there's some reason why they didn't slow down, like they were trying to auto rotate and they couldn't, or controlled flight into terrain, right? CFIT, which if you were controlled flight into terrain daytime, why was your visibility so low? Like, were you low and into fog, and you were below what was considered even special VFR rules? Does that make sense, Mac?
Yeah, and I have to I want to ask you if you sent me a link, and what the link does is it couples the radar track with the audio with subtitles of the communication between the various towers in the greater Los Angeles basin and the aircraft. What is that? I've never seen it. It's incredible to watch.
Yeah, well, it's so again, this is very public
Right.
access, right? So you can literally pull the air traffic control tapes, and they'll show the radar track, and especially something like this, like there's some pretty smart savvy people out there. They quickly boom boom put it together, and they can throw it up, and that's where I got it. And
Wow.
it's pretty powerful, right?
For every listening who's again, I think we're all struggling, like, how could this happen? And again, I mean, Kobe Bryant, I mean, obviously a great basketball player, but the stuff he was doing in his life now, with his four daughters, I want to say his youngest is 7 months. What he's doing promoting women's sports, he was writing. It was interesting to hear Jerry West talk about that part of his life, and he was creating. And Jerry West said, the greatest things he would do on this planet were in front of him, because he was not your typical athlete. He grew up in Europe. He spoke, he speaks Italian. He speaks Spanish, right? He's, when it came time for the Olympics, to play in the Olympics, and some players were like, well, I'm not sure if I want to. He was like, I'm all in. And I'm gonna stay in the Olympic Village, and I'm gonna be there the whole time too. I'm not going home. I've always wanted to do this. I've always wanted, and I want to be around other cultures because I love it. He was a different dude, and so I think, yesterday, as the news kind of percolated, you just said, like, how could this happen? Somebody that has, that kind of money to have, a great helicopter, to hire, an eminently qualified pilot. How does this happen? And then seeing this, I mean, honestly, and I'll put the link in the post that'll go up here in a little bit, but you're seeing the conversation between the tower and where that track is on the map of the LA Basin. It's honestly, it's amazing to watch.
Well, and here's the thing that, you know, in regards to what he was doing, that's why he built Black Mamba, right? Was to pay it forward and to help young athletes, you know, and get them continued on the right track for athletics, because he is what of all a lot of us experience. He's living proof of what athletics can do for you from a work ethic, a discipline, team, you know, what I would consider a team camaraderie, working in a team. Like he's felt all that throughout his life, and now it's his time to pay it forward. And that's why he built Black Mamba, right? Was to continue to foster that for young athletes.
And you know, I mean,
very selfless. No, very selfless.
Well, I saw a high school guy get interviewed who was outside of the gated community where Kobe lives. So there was a kind of a shrine, you know, developed there yesterday, and people showed up that live in Orange County and with flowers, and much like, you know, I think that happened near the crash site and at Staples Center. And this kid said, I saw him in the supermarket, right? And I went up and I said, I'm not much of a basketball player, you know, I'm a football player. And he said, he looked at me and said, it doesn't matter. He said, what you need to do is go out and get better every day. He said, and if you do that, those benefits will transfer into your life, whether you stay playing football or not, because it's not about athletics. And this kid tells us, you know, just this cool story of bumping into Kobe Bryant in the supermarket and saying, I'm not a basketball player. And him looking at him and saying, it doesn't matter, man. Work hard, get better every day. That's the secret to being good at life. And so, you know, and so again, the head scratcher of, you know, this guy who was having, and then I saw a woman who's a basketball coach talking about him, and he said, she said, you know, I coach at Westminster High School. It's predominantly Black school, and we asked Kobe, would he come by, and we didn't think he actually would, and he said, sure. What time do you want me there? And he showed up. He said, you know, he went through part of the practice with us. He hung out with the girls. Right. And then he gave this great talk. And then, you know, he would occasionally text me and say, hey, you know, no love for me, man. What am I? I'm not going to get invited back. Right. And she talked about this profound effect that he had had on her life. And so that's why I wanted to have you on today, because, you know, you're looking at this going, and his 13-year-old daughter, man, how the fuck could this happen?
And I'll say, you know, listening to all the tapes, like, it felt very normal to me until they got up and they were up near, I think it was either Burbank or Van Nuys, and they started talking to them about holding and that they just had a citation go around.
Right.
As an aviator, I'm starting to do the sucking teeth sound. Like, is the weather, like, the weather must have been pretty low if you're telling me that you're having to hold me so that you can get enough spacing for me to cross across your airport, because you've got instrument approaches coming in and you just had a citation go around. Like, that's pretty low dense fog, right? That you're telling me that citation just went around. Now, maybe that citation went around because they had something else, but most airplanes go around because they didn't break out and they didn't see the airport. So, you know, that's TBD. But I'm just saying, like, that I started doing a sucking T sound. Then they start pressing west and you start hearing the back and forth. And then they start saying, since, you know, like, they basically start losing communications with them, which, again, line of sight with radio, it's all about altitude, right? The higher you go, the further away you can transmit. The lower you go, terrain becomes a factor. So then the last kind of things we hear is, they're having trouble keeping track of them on the radar, and they're having trouble communicating with them. That's lower altitude. So why descend? Well, are you having mechanical issues? Are you losing situational awareness? Or maybe this is familiarity and you're like, hey, if we shoot the, you know, this is not what I would do, but this would be something that could be said, is if we come in this way, I can get you up that way. And you see what I'm saying? Like, it becomes a little bit of a cowboy mentality. And I'm not saying they did that, but I'm saying that there's been documentation that has happened. And, you know, we don't know until we find out. And there, another good thing to realize is there's going to be two things that are going to be recovered from this aircraft. And that's one thing that's good about, if there's anything good about this horrible tragedy, is this: they have the crash site, they have the wreckage, right? So they can do a thorough accident investigation. First thing that they're going to pull is the cockpit voice recorder. They're going to be able to hear not only what the pilot's talking about outside the airplane, i.e. to ATC, they're going to be able to hear the inner monologue and the back and forth with the pilot. The last thing they're going to be able to pull from a recording aspect is there will be a recording, a tape that the aircraft should have that'll show its parameters, right? It'll show everything from the power, the altitude, the airspeed, the descent angle, the descent rate. All of that will be captured, and newer airplanes all have that technology. And this right. Sikorsky, I'm assuming even in the 90s, when it was built in like 1991, it should have that. So that's, if there's anything good, is they'll be able to salvage that. The last thing is, as all of us accident investigators have been trained to do, is they have actual material, right? It didn't go into the water, and like I've had to do an accident investigation where an airplane hit the water and sunk to the bottom 1,000 feet below. Like, there's not much you get from a tactile substance. This case, they have it, right? So they'll be able to pull that engine and they'll go, oh, well, here's where this problem happened. Or, oh, I see this blade had a crack on it. Like, they'll be able to analyze and figure out if there was a mechanical issue. So the evidence will be there that should be able to accurately describe and figure out what exactly took place.
You know, I can't remember which one I saw, whether it was the TWA flight over Lockerbie or the wreckage from the Malaysian flight that went down in the Ukraine that the Russians shot down. I can't remember which one, but it was, right, it was, there's this huge hangar, and there's this frame made of, it looked like 2x4s and chicken wire. And mm-hmm. on that frame, they start hanging pieces. And it's
yep.
like,
oh, yeah, you start rebuilding the whole plane. That's
right.
Exactly.
And I was amazed at, you know, and they showed this mosaic that they reassembled. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you can see, I want to say it was the TWA flight from Lockerbie. And, you know, you could see the ball bearing holes in the fuselage. You could see. And you're like, holy shit, man.
Mm-hmm.
Holy
yep.
shit. The, you know, when the video that you just showed me that I'll put up for everybody, you know, there's no mayday. There's no distress. That thing is, they're cleared south. They're cleared to move south by, they go out of the Van Nuys, you know, ATC, I guess, sphere.
Towers Airspace, yep,
right.
yep.
And they transfer to SoCal. You know, mm-hmm. 1, 3, 4.
Which is standard. That's standard. They go from Burbank to Van Nuys, which is called tower to tower.
Right.
If you look at the airspace, they do overlap, or they basically butt, they're next door neighbors, so to speak. So they're just handing off from one tower to another tower. That's very standard,
right?
But then you start hearing, I believe it's the female Van Nuys controller, and she's starting talking about airplanes going around at Van Nuys, which I've landed Van Nuys multiple times. It can be sporty. Because you have rising terrain out to the west, and the instrument landing system, the ILS, lands to the south. And if you go missed, it can get very busy, because what's just to the south of Van Nuys? LAX, like in your face, right? So you're going to have to probably come off, and I would assume either go east or go west, depending on how they vector you, and it can get very busy. And if Van Nuys is having some low weather that day, it could be varsity. So, but that handoff, the Burbank to Van Nuys is very normal. And then when it starts getting a little bit kind of what I consider be a little bit sucking T sound, is then they get handed off to SoCal, which is normal because
right.
it's SoCal's airspace out to the west there. And, but now SoCal's saying, look, we're you know, basically we're having a hard time hearing you, and we're having a hard time seeing you. What are you doing and where are you going? Like
right.
that's kind of that back and forth that we call the push pull, right? Like, what's your intentions? Like, where are you going? And because we want to keep up with you, but there's a point where ATC is going to say, look, bro, you're a special VFR. I can't see you. I can't talk to you. You're on your own. Like, there's, you know, we'll talk about this when you land if I need to, but there's a point where they're going to say, like, I can't communicate or watch anymore. No longer is flight following available, and you're out. Like I can't, you're on your own. Right. So that the controller, one of the last transmissions is, hey, you're squawking 1200, which means you're VFR. But do you want to pick up flight following? Like, do you want me to follow you along your flight plan? And then that's probably one of the last things that it's transmitted. And then it kind of, you know, it kind of dissipates from there. So.
Got it. All right. Any other thoughts about this that I haven't, I've been, smart enough, to ask you about?
I can't think of anything else that we didn't touch on. I know we've been talking for over an hour, but, I think what your listener touched on is so important as we've dove into every type of either aviation mishap or accident or, even an event is it's important to talk about the facts. And you always tend to come back to what is factual. Let's talk about what exactly occurred. What do we know? And then we can start putting into what happened, right? The speculation for shock value is what annoys me, which is why I haven't even turned on the news today, because I don't even want to go down that road.
Right.
It's like, but what do we know, right? And what we know is, as you and I both experienced yesterday, you know, weather was low. There was fog in the area. We do know that. We do know that it was a high priority lift, right? He's Kobe Bryant. He's the bill payer for the plane. He's my boss, found the pilot. And the priority is to get him up to his training facility. That's a pressure, right? He's also, there's a factor that there was many people on board. So people equal weight. So you got a heavy aircraft, right? You're flying low. You're in a helicopter. So your margin for error is low. Then the last thing is he's through a busy airspace, right? So you're going from out of John Wayne Airport, you're transitioning along the east side of LAX. You come up into Burbank to Van Nuys, and then you're proceeding west, which is becomes kind of back to open country. But that's where the problems start to compound. And that's where we start getting into the land of the unknown, right? So the Swiss cheese was definitely lining up for what I would consider a very, very varsity day to be flying yesterday.
And truth be told, I mean, if he goes up there as often as supposedly he did, it's not like they had never flown in limited visibility. And
this is very standard. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So what is your – as I watch the track and I watch the conversation, right, they get cleared to come back to the 101 from the north, and then they crash with no mayday call or anything. It just seems to me like, I don't know, when I look at it, it just seems like whether it's a lack of situational awareness because the visibility was so poor, not looking at, you know, your GPS and your map to see that you just flew over the 101 as you headed south, and then within seconds you impact the, you impact hills.
Even in a helicopter, you're contention. That's doing 3 miles a minute, right? So they're traveling over the ground pretty dang fast. If the pilot became disoriented or lost situational awareness, you're traveling very quickly over the ground. Again, single pilot. That's another huge causal, that'll be determined, but it's definitely a component that we know it makes us higher risk is a single pilot, right? So when you're dual pilot, you've got two people up there, two brains working, like, where are we going? What are we doing? One could be navigating, one could be flying. Single pilot, you're doing that all by yourself, right? And whether Kobe was quote unquote, certified, or I don't know if he was checked out to fly this thing or not. Sounds like he might've done some flying on his own.
Right.
Who was at controls? That'll be another component here. But the fact is that what I understand is this pilot was the rated pilot and was essentially single pilot. So that's another big, what I consider like a situation. The component to this mishap is single pilot adds a lot of workload to you. But what is another thing in aviation, and it applies to most anything we do in life, right, is familiarity tends to breed complacency, right? We got this. We're familiar. Well, that tends to suck you into the hole of being complacent, right? So another, as you touched on it, Mac, is maybe they've done this 500 times in the last 3 years. We don't know. But if they have, that familiarity can sometimes lead into complacency. And, oh, well, no, we're familiar. We got this. We'll just come up this way. And, you know, we know that point. Well, if you can't exactly see the ground and where you think you are and where you actually are different, that could be a cause, you know, a cause, right? So that'll be something that we'll see in the accident investigation.
Got it. All right. Well, first of all, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for coming on and doing this today. I always, you know, learn an absolute, you know, shit ton when we do this. Whether, and we've done this, I mean, sad to say, we've done this more times than we care to. Whether it's in when Joey came on for the F-18 KC-130 event a couple years ago off the coast of Japan, whether it was Major Norton flying up at 29 Palms. And so people have a ton of questions and don't understand, you know, and you and Joey are always great about coming on and explaining things. And also, the reason why I do this is you're always respectful of the difficulty involved and how fast things happen up there. And you don't stray where I would tell you that makes me uncomfortable, makes everybody else uncomfortable, which is, you know, which is somebody made a mistake or whatnot. And so a class act, Rudy, you and both Joey when he comes on as well. So I just want to thank you for doing this, helping us understand the factors up there when you're flying around in limited visibility. And when you have that many people on a helicopter, and how quick it moves, and just helping us understand something that, you know, had a profound effect on the entire nation. And if you saw the soccer world, you know, he was a huge, you know, he grew up in Italy. He said, "Yeah, basketball was not my sport as a kid, right? The sport everybody came to and the sport I wanted to be good at was soccer." And you know, and the soccer world reacting yesterday to his death. You know, guys like Messi and Ronaldo. I mean, they got the biggest names arguably in athletics in the world because of the popularity of soccer. I mean, stop what they do because they knew him and whatnot. So and then
well, I was standing, you know, it was crazy as I was standing next to, you know, a guy I've been, you know, closest of friends with growing up, and we were at the Grand National Roaster Show yesterday, and Mike Thompson and I were standing there, and it came across the PA, and it just took the wind out of me because, one, it was aviation, two, it was Kobe Bryant, the superstar, and then I start thinking about he's a dad. And then I start thinking about the time that the personal interaction I had with him that day and how I saw his love for his family firsthand. And man, I drove home from Pomona yesterday, you know, and I was just, I mean, have you ever been driving and it's like that, you know, 90-minute drive takes about 20 minutes. You're like, where the hell did that go? It's like my brain was just going 100 miles an hour yesterday of just, how the hell did this happen? And what a tragedy, because what an amazing, amazing, you know, athlete and father and husband. And I just, man, it just took, I mean, literally took the breath out of me yesterday. I was just, it was
tragic. I talked earlier, you know, Colleen was playing volleyball maybe 3 or 4 years ago in middle school, right? And his oldest daughter is Colleen's, I think, maybe 6 months or a year older than Colleen, but I think they're in the same class. I think they're both juniors in high school. And, you know, I wasn't there, but Catherine tells me, yeah, Dad. And in walks Kobe Bryant. And he's just, you know, just a dad standing against the wall, you know, watching his daughter play volleyball. And so around this part of Orange County, you know, and then the baseball coach, they were 3 blocks from my house yesterday. With all that went on with that at Orange Coast College, it's right, you know, a stone's throw from where I live. So, you know, he, you know, and then the other thing, you know, his wife, you know, they're a Catholic family, right? And a church going Catholic family. And so, yeah, that part of it is just, you know, and then a baby 7 months will never know her father or never know one of her sisters. And just a terrible, terrible story. But I, again, thank you, Rudy, always a class act. And he's got three names, right? Rudy, his call sign, F-18 man, which is how people know him on the show, and his actual name, Kurt Knowles. So, no, class act. Want to thank you for coming on and explaining this and help us at least frame us and know what to look for going forward. So I appreciate it.
No, absolutely, man. We'll talk in better situation hopefully soon. So
yeah. All right. Thanks.
All right. Thanks to you.
You bet. A great friend of mine, Kurt Knowles, battle buddies from Afghanistan. And, he's one of my great friends and, borrows my tools and my ladders on occasion. But he always brings it back. Always brings it back, right? And major flaw as a human being, he's got an emblem, Marine Corps emblem on his truck that's crooked. Yeah, it's just like a little bit crooked too. And he's in the, but I'll say this. I respect because he won't admit it. He won't admit that it's crooked. And anyway, no, I have some great friends. He's one of them. But anyway, I don't want to say I enjoy that stuff, but it certainly helps me as to figure some of this stuff out that you see and you don't rightly understand it, especially in the aviation community, which is beyond my level of comprehension. So we're gonna take a break, and then you'll hear it tomorrow. The regularly scheduled programming was Montana Man coming on to talk about a Marine that he lost and in Somalia 27 years ago. And the anniversary of his Marine's death. And his name is Batello. He's Lance Corporal Batello. With Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 7th Marines, in Somalia. And the story is kind of a cool story about how his Marines, still 27 years later, rally around that family. And, it's tough to do when you're on active duty. So staying connected hard on active duty. When you get done with active duty, though, you get a chance. And Rob had a chance to reconnect with him over the weekend. So I wanted to have him on and tell that story a little bit. So we'll do that tomorrow. And then kind of humorous, kind of not, though, Chris Cox got back from vacation in Hawaii, right? And so... So Chris said that he had lost like 11 pounds while he was on vacation. And Dave in Vacaville got pissed. Right? Dave in Vacaville was like, what? What is that? You'll hear from Chris about his time on vacation in Hawaii a little bit, but then how do you lose weight? And know this, Chris Cox down from 500 pounds. He said I might have weighed more, but the scale wouldn't go any higher. And now at 231 pounds. So so you'll hear Chris Cox. You'll hear both of them tomorrow. And again, my thanks to. My thanks to F-18 Man for coming on today and doing this. So, anyway, tomorrow I'll tell you a couple stories about experiences over the weekend. And very cool post-traumatic winning experiences over the weekend. Marines changing people's lives who both reach out to me out of the blue, right? I was working around my house, cleaning, writing, doing some other stuff. And my phone rings and says, "Hey, sir, could I talk to you? I'm trying to help somebody, and I'm not sure I'm doing the right thing." I said, "You bet." Then I got an email from another Marine who had just seen post-traumatic wounding a couple weeks ago, said he wanted to reach out and tell me what an impact it had on him. So I picked up the phone. He put his phone number in there. I called him like 2 seconds later. And when I said, "Hey, this is Mike McNamara," he's like, "Holy shit, man, I just hit send." Right? I'm like, "Yeah, that'll teach you to put your phone number in, that son of a bitch." And then I had another Marine who told me that, post-traumatic winnings impacted his life so much, he's going to change the direction of his life. And so he and I will have dinner tomorrow night. So I would encourage you to go out and change somebody's life. It's a pretty cool experience. And I would heartily recommend that to you. So, on a Monday, we'll take a break. On the backside of the break, this program begins again. Tomorrow, you will hear Chris Cox. You will also hear Montana Man, Rob Schwarz, as we had to roll those interviews to tomorrow. So, have a great one. On a Monday, the last Monday in January, All Marine Radio, over and out.